There are stories that begin with screams, and then there are stories that begin with silence. The kind of silence that settles over a house after a door has closed for the last time that day. The kind that drifts through a quiet hallway while everyone else is still asleep. The kind that fills the space between a parent's last glance at their child and the moment they realize he isn't there anymore. That's how this story begins. Not with violence. Not with a cry for help. Not with anything a neighbor would have noticed from across the street. Just silence. A 15-year-old boy. A rural county. A patch of Midwestern woods stretching for miles in every direction. And somewhere inside all of that ordinary stillness, a teenager named Glenn Brown, quietly, carefully, disappeared. What followed would become one of the most unusual missing person cases the region had seen in years. A case that would stretch across state lines. A case that would pull in local deputies, city detectives, and federal agents. A case that would leave an entire community holding its breath for days, waiting for news that might never come. Tonight, we're stepping into the woods behind that silence. Tonight, we're following a trail that almost wasn't a trail at all. This is the story of Glenn Brown. I'm Maya Vale. This is Among Monsters. And before we go any further, I want to say something out loud, because I think it matters. Not every story we tell on this show ends the way this one does. Some of the cases we talk through are tragedies. Some are unsolved. Some haunt us long after the episode fades out. But this one is different. This is a story about a boy who vanished and was found. A story about survival, about instinct, about a community that didn't give up, about a network of people spread across hundreds of miles who stayed locked on a single question until it had an answer. It is, in its own quiet way, a story about hope. And I think we need those right now. So settle in, dim the lights, let the world outside your window slip away for a little while. Because we're going back to mid-May of 2025 to a small corner of the Midwest, where an ordinary afternoon was about to become something no one in that town would ever forget. Calhoun County. If you've never been, picture it this way. Long stretches of two-lane road that curve through farmland. Thick pockets of trees that swallow sound as soon as you step into them. Small towns that still feel like small towns, where people wave at strangers, where everyone seems to know everyone's cousin, where the night sky isn't drowned out by city lights. It is the kind of place where kids grow up knowing the land, where backyards bleed into fields, where a teenager can slip out the back door on a warm spring afternoon and be half a mile into the tree line before anyone even notices they're gone. Glenn Brown was 15 years old, still a kid in so many ways, still figuring out who he was, where he fit, what the world was asking of him, still balancing the weight of growing up against the softer, simpler parts of being a teenager. We won't pretend to know his inner life. We won't guess at his reasons. We won't try to script a mind that only one person could truly narrate, and that person is Glenn himself. What we do know is this. Glenn was resourceful. Glenn was comfortable outdoors. Glenn knew, in a way many of his peers did not, how to move through the natural world without leaving much of a mark behind. And on a day in mid-May of 2025, Glenn left. At first, no alarm bells rang. Teenagers leave. That's part of the truth we sometimes forget when we look at cases like this from the outside. They get frustrated. They argue. They need space. They walk out the door. They cool off in a park or at a friend's house or on a long, aimless loop around the neighborhood. And then, most of the time, they come home. That's the statistical reality of missing teen reports. The vast majority resolve within hours. A parent calls, a child answers. Relief settles in. Life moves on. So when Glenn didn't come back right away, there was concern. Of course there was. But there was also that familiar, almost reflective reassurance. He'll be back soon. He just needs to clear his head. He'll walk through that door any minute now. Except, he didn't. Hours turned into the rest of the day. The rest of the day turned into dusk. Dusk turned into night. And somewhere inside that slow, creepy progression of time, a feeling began to settle in the pit of the household's stomach. This wasn't the usual pattern. This was something else. By the next morning, concern had sharpened into something urgent. The family called for help. Law enforcement responded. A missing person report was filed. And almost immediately, the machinery of a search operation began to turn. If you've never seen a rural search mobilized in real time, it is a strange thing to witness. It is both slow and explosively fast. It moves at the speed of paperwork and radio calls on one end, and at the speed of adrenaline and desperation on the other. Deputies began canvassing neighborhoods. Detectives started interviews. Officers walked property lines, knocked on doors, talked to neighbors who had been sitting on porches the day before, asking the same careful questions over and over. Did you see anything? Did you hear anything? A car door? A voice? A figure moving through the tree line? Anything at all? Volunteers began showing up. That's one of the things about rural communities that outsiders don't always understand. When a child goes missing, people come. They come in trucks and on foot. They come with flashlights and water bottles and their own dogs. They walk fields they've walked 100 times before, looking at them with new eyes. Search teams formed lines. Drones lifted into the air. Aerial units began mapping the terrain in wide, sweeping grids, scanning for anything that didn't belong. A flash of color, a disturbed patch of earth, a shape in the brush that didn't match the trees around it. And as all of this unfolded, something began to take shape, a theory. Not the theory investigators had walked in expecting. Not the usual picture of a frightened kid wandering aimlessly through the woods. Something else. Something that, the more they looked at it, began to feel almost deliberate. Glenn, investigators began to believe, was surviving. Not panicking. Not stumbling. Surviving. Let's sit with that word for a moment. Surviving. Because it changes the shape of the whole case. When we hear that a teenager has gone missing in the outdoors, most of us, if we're honest, picture something specific. We picture fear. We picture confusion. We picture a kid lost in the trees, calling out, hoping someone will hear. That mental image does a lot of work in how these searches are run. It shapes where teams look. It shapes how quickly they expect to find signs. It shapes the assumption that the missing person wants to be found. But Glenn's case didn't fit that picture. As the hours became days, investigators began to notice a pattern. There were no signs of distress in the obvious places. No clothing snagged on branches. No abandoned supplies, no improvised signals for help. And that absence was telling, because it suggested something very specific. It suggested that Glenn wasn't trying to be found. The sheriff's office began piecing together a working theory, a theory that painted a picture both impressive and deeply unsettling for the people trying to locate him. Glenn, they believe, may have been using campers, sheds, outbuildings, hidden structures tucked behind houses, at the edges of fields, deep in wooded properties where most people wouldn't think to look. Places easy to overlook. Places that, from the road, look like any other piece of faded farm life. A leaning shed with a rusted padlock. A camper parked behind a tree line, forgotten since last summer. A hunting cabin that nobody's used in years. To most of us, those structures are background scenery. Part of the landscape we drive past without ever really seeing. But for someone who understands how to move through rural country, those places are gold. They offer cover from the weather, cover from the eyes of passing drivers, cover from drones, which can scan open fields with precision, but struggle to see beneath a roof. They offer a place to sit, a place to rest, a place to wait for dark. And that was the other piece of the pattern. Investigators came to believe that Glenn was avoiding roads during the daytime. He wasn't hitchhiking. He wasn't flagging down drivers. He wasn't standing at crossroads trying to be seen. He was moving at the edges, through the trees, along the backs of properties, at the seams of the map where the world thins out and no one really watches. He was moving, in other words, like someone who understands exactly how to stay out of sight. There's a particular kind of difficulty in searching for someone who is actively avoiding being found. It is not the same as searching for someone who is lost. When a person is lost, the search works with them. They want to be seen. They call out. They try to get to high ground. They stay near trails, near roads, near anything that might flag their location to a passing eye. They are, in every instinct, leaning towards rescue. When a person is avoiding rescue, every one of those instincts flips. They move away from sound, not toward it. They stay off high ground because high ground is where drones see best. They stay away from trails. They rest during the day, when everyone is looking, and they travel at night, when fewer eyes are watching. They become, in effect, their own counter-search team, reading the searchers, anticipating the patterns, staying one step ahead of the grid. That is not a kind of behavior search teams encounter every day. Most of their training is built around finding the lost. Finding someone who doesn't want to be found is a different discipline entirely. It requires different tactics, different assumptions, different patience. And it is, at its heart, a much harder problem to solve. Now, it's important to pause here and be careful about something. It is easy, when we hear details like this, to start building a character in our heads. The mysterious kid in the woods. The teenager with survival skills, the near-mythical figure slipping between sheds like a ghost. But Glenn was not a character. He was a real 15-year-old boy, a child. Whatever skills he had, whatever instincts were guiding him, whatever reason were steering him away from people trying to reach him, those things belonged to a real young life, a life with a family waiting for news, a life with a future still ahead of it. A life that could at any moment intersect with something far beyond his ability to manage on his own. That's the thing about survival in the wild. It sounds romantic from a distance. It is not romantic up close. Nights get cold, even in May. Rain can turn even familiar woods into something unrecognizable. Hunger hollows out decision making. Dehydration comes quietly and moves fast. Cuts get infected. Ankles turn on uneven ground. Simple injuries in the wrong setting become serious ones. And beyond the physical toll, there is a mental one. Isolation does things to the human mind, especially a young one, especially one that is already carrying whatever weight led it into the woods in the first place. That's why investigators, as skilled and respectful as they were about Glenn's resourcefulness, kept coming back to a single, sobering phrase. While Glenn is known to be resourceful in the outdoors, that was how the sheriff's office framed it publicly. They acknowledged the skill. They respected the instinct. They were not going to underestimate a young man who had clearly learned something real about how to handle himself in nature. But then came the second half of the sentence. The length of time he had been missing is pushing the limits of what anyone could realistically endure on their own. Read that again slowly. The limits of what anyone could realistically endure. Not the limits of a teenager. Not the limits of an untrained hiker. Anyone. That phrasing was a warning. A quiet, careful, publicly worded warning aimed at anyone who might still be assuming this was going to be fine on its own. Because every hour that passed pulled Glenn closer to the edge of that limit. Days stretched on, and the strange, suspended quality of a prolonged search began to settle over the community. If you've ever lived through one, it's hard to describe. Time doesn't move normally. You wake up in the morning and you reach for your phone before your eyes even fully open, looking for news. You scroll, nothing. You make coffee, you check again, nothing. You go to work, and you can't quite focus. You think about him. You wonder if today will be the day. Everywhere you drive, you find yourself looking at tree lines differently, at sheds, at camper shells on the back of properties. You glance twice at shadows near barns. You notice every patch of woods you normally wouldn't notice. The whole landscape sharpens. The whole community holds its breath. And in Calhoun County, that held breath stretched from one day to two to three. Drones kept flying. Canine teams kept working scent trails. Aerial scans kept mapping the terrain. Tip lines stayed open. Every call was taken seriously. Every sighting, every odd detail, I think I saw someone behind my neighbor's shed last night, was logged, cross-referenced, followed up. But still, no confirmed sightings, no clear direction, no photograph, no solid footprint, no discarded items that investigators could hold up and say, yes, this is him. This is where he was. We have the trail. Just fragments. Just echoes. Just a slow, maddening sense that a young life was moving somewhere out there, just ahead of the people trying to reach him. And then, on May 15th, something shifted. A tip came in, but it didn't come from a neighbor who had seen movement in a shed. It didn't come from a hunter who had stumbled across a campsite in the woods. It didn't come from a dog team cutting through brush. It came from a train. A witness somewhere along the route reported seeing a young man who matched Glenn's description. Traveling alone, quiet, not in distress, not visibly afraid. The train had been heading to Chicago. Let that land for a second. Chicago, the third largest city in the United States, hundreds of miles from the rural Midwest fields where a massive, multi-agency ground search had been tearing through woods and back roads for days. And here was Glenn, if the tip was accurate, quietly riding north, crossing state lines, stepping out of the story everyone had been telling about him, and into a completely new one. The witness didn't just see him on the train. They saw him arrive. They watched him step off, somewhere at the end of that line, and disappear into the biggest, densest, loudest city in the country. Think for a moment about the contrast. A few days earlier, Glenn had been somewhere behind a tree line in rural Calhoun County. Quiet. Wooded. The kind of place where the loudest sound at night might be a distant dog, or wind moving through the leaves, or the faint hum of a highway miles away. Now, if the tip was accurate, he was walking into Union Station, into a vaulted hall of marble and noise. Into a city of nearly 3 million people, where the skyline alone can disorient someone who has never seen it before. Into traffic, into brake lights, into the hum of a city and does not notice. For a 15-year-old from rural country, that transition alone is hard to imagine. The sheer sensory weight of it, the speed, the density, the way every corner opens into a new intersection full of strangers. Whatever was pulling him north, whatever he was walking toward or away from, he had just stepped into a completely different world. And somewhere inside that world, still alive, still moving, still on scene. He had to be found. That single tip did something remarkable. It redrew the entire map of the investigation. Suddenly, the rural search, the one centered on sheds and campers and wooded properties, was no longer the center of the case. It had been just hours before. Now it wasn't. Now the case had moved to concrete, to steel, to crowds. Calhoun County began to slowly, carefully, step down its active ground search. That decision is always difficult. No agency wants to look like it's giving up. No community wants to feel like the search has been abandoned. But responsible investigators follow evidence. And the evidence at that moment was pointing somewhere else. The sheriff's office made its position clear. They were not giving up. They were not walking away. They were following the trail. And the trail, for the first time in days, had direction. With that direction came partners. The Chicago Police Department. The FBI field office. Because once a case crosses state lines, once it moves from a rural stretch of farmland into one of America's largest urban centers, the nature of the investigation changes entirely. The tools change. The strategies change. The whole rhythm of the search changes. In a rural setting, the problem is often visibility. Too much land. Too few eyes. A missing person can simply be on the wrong side of a hill, and no one will ever know for hours. In a city, the problem flips completely. There are cameras on every corner. There are witnesses everywhere. There are records of trains, buses, transit cards, shelter check-ins, hospital intake logs. In one sense, a city is harder to disappear in than a forest. But in another sense, it's much, much easier. Because the signal-to-noise ratio is brutal. A single 15-year-old boy walking alone down a Chicago street is one face in a river of thousands. He is one silhouette among countless silhouettes. He is one kid in a city that handles millions of movements every day, most of them unremarkable, most of them unseen. Finding him would not be about searching harder. It would be about searching smarter. And that is exactly what began to happen. Behind the scenes, in the hours after the train tip, there was an extraordinary amount of work happening that the public never really saw. Information was being shared in real time across multiple agencies. Photographs were circulated internally. Transit footage was pulled. Patrol officers were briefed. Shelters and youth outreach organizations were quietly notified. Social service networks, the kind that often intersect with teenagers in big cities, were put on alert. All of it happening fast. All of it happening simultaneously. All of it pointed at a single goal. Find Glenn. And find him before something, anything, went wrong. May 16th, one day after the critical tip. In a case like this, one day can feel like a very long time. Because a day in a city is enough for a teenager to move several miles. Enough to change neighborhoods, enough to bump into the wrong person, enough for a window of opportunity to quietly close. Every person working this case understood that, which is why, when the call finally came in, it carried the kind of weight that everyone in the chain had been bracing for. At approximately 5:40 p.m., the Chicago Police Department located Glenn Brown. He was safe. He was, as far as the initial report indicated, uninjured. After days of uncertainty, after a rural search that had pulled in dozens of agencies, volunteers, and resources, after a city that had quietly mobilized behind the scenes, a 15-year-old boy had flipped through woods and sheds and train cars and crowded streets, was finally, finally in the hands of people who could bring him home. The official statement was almost understated in its language. Glenn Lee Brown had been located safely in Chicago. Three simple sentences, really. But behind those sentences were hundreds of hours of work, thousands of miles of coordination, countless prayers from a community that had spent days refreshing its phones, waiting for exactly this. Arrangements were quickly made to reunite Glenn with his family. And I want to sit here for just a moment in the quiet of that word, reunite. It's such a small word for what it actually looks like. Because a reunion after something like this isn't just a hug. It's the first time in days that a parent breathes all the way out. It's the first time in days that a sibling doesn't check the front window every time they hear a car slow down. It's the first time in days that an entire family room isn't heavy with that specific, airless weight that settles over a home when someone is missing and no one knows anything. It is silence breaking. It is a phone call answered. It is a door opening. It is a voice in the hallway that, for a few days, hadn't been there. It is the sound of someone setting keys down on a counter and a room full of people turning at once. It is the moment everyone has been picturing in their heads, trying not to picture in their heads, failing to stop picturing in their heads for days on end. And then suddenly it's real. He's home. He's safe. Whatever comes next, conversations, questions, healing, understanding can finally begin. Because the one thing that had to happen first has happened. Stories like this don't always end this way. This is not a throwaway line. That is the truth of this kind of work. For every case that closes with a safe return, there are others that do not. There are families who wait and never get that call. There are search teams who come home with their heads down. There are communities who bury someone instead of welcoming them back. So when a case ends with the words, found safe, we do not take that for granted on this show. We hold it. We honor it. We let it mean something. There are, of course, questions. There always are. Why did Glenn leave? What was happening in his life? How did he manage at 15 years old to survive on his own for that stretch of time, moving through both wilderness and city, staying largely invisible to the people trying to find him? What was he thinking as he walked through the woods that night, as he boarded that train, as he stepped off in a city he may never have seen before? Those are real questions. And it would be dishonest for me to pretend I know the answers, because I don't. Neither does law enforcement publicly. Neither do the volunteers who walk the fields. Neither do any of us listening right now. And honestly, maybe that's as it should be. Because Glenn is a minor. He is a young person who had just went through something that most adults could never have endured. Whatever he was carrying before he left, whatever moved him to disappear, whatever happened in those hidden hours between Calhoun County and Chicago belonged to him and to the people closest to him and to the private work of healing that is now ahead of that family. Our job on a show like this is not to pry open every door. Our job is to honor the story, to walk through it with care, to hold space for what can be shared, and to step back respectfully from what cannot. So instead of speculation, let's close on what this story actually shows us. First, it shows us something about communities, about rural communities specifically, about the way people in small counties mobilize when a child goes missing, about neighbors who drop what they're doing, about volunteers who show up without being asked, about law enforcement officers who work past their shifts, not because they have to, but because the idea is going home while a 15-year-old boy is still out there is simply not acceptable to them. Second, it shows us something about coordination. The fact that a rural sheriff's office, an urban police department, and the federal field agency could pivot together across state lines in the space of a single day is not small. It is not automatic. It is the result of years of relationships, training, and systems built for exactly this kind of moment. Those systems don't always work. When they do, as they did here, it is worth noticing, and it is worth naming the specific, unglamorous work that makes those systems hold together. The deputy who stays late because paperwork can wait, but a missing kid can't. The city officer who recognizes a face on a bulletin and slows down to take a second look. The federal analysis who pulls transit footage at 2 a.m. because a timeline is tightening. The dispatcher who fields a tip from a nervous witness and treats it with the same seriousness as a formal statement. None of those roles make the news. None of them get the photograph at the end, standing next to a smiling family. Most of them will never meet the person they helped find, but every one of them is part of how a case like this gets solved. And when the story ends the way this one ended, they are part of the reason why. Third, it shows us something about young people. Something we don't talk about enough, that teenagers, even in crisis, can carry more capability than adults around them sometimes realize. That resourcefulness can live inside a 15-year-old body in ways that surprise us. That a kid raised with one foot in the natural world can do things in the woods that trained adults would struggle with. That is not a celebration of running away. That is a recognition of resilience, because those same skills can also be channeled into scouting, into wilderness programs, into outdoor careers, into a life that uses those instincts for something sustaining rather than something solitary. And fourth, it shows us something about hope, that hope is not a naive thing. Hope is not the opposite of realism. Hope is not pretending the danger isn't real. Hope is not ignoring the statistics or the risk or the very real possibility that a story like this might have ended very differently. Hope is what keeps people walking the tree line on day 3. Hope is what keeps a mother's phone charged and turned up, even at 2 in the morning. Hope is what sends a tip to a hotline from a train somewhere in the Midwest. Hope is the thing that holds a community upright during the days it doesn't yet know how the story ends. And sometimes, not always, but sometimes, hope is rewarded. A tip comes in, a call is made, a boy is found. And a family gets to do the one thing they had been praying, quietly, endlessly, to be able to do again. Open the door and let him inside. Glenn Brown was missing. Glenn Brown was searched for. Glenn Brown was found safe. 3 sentences, 3 chapters, 3 moments that, together, form a story that most of us will only ever read about from the outside. But that, for one family in the rural Midwest, will be part of the fabric of their lives forever. They will remember the day the door closed. They will remember the nights in between. They will remember the phone ringing at 5:40 in the evening on May 16th. They will remember the drive, the reunion, the first meal together, the first ordinary morning that no longer felt ordinary, because ordinary is something you only truly appreciate after it has been taken from you, even briefly. And somewhere inside all of that, Glenn himself will carry his own version of this story, one that none of us will ever fully see, one that belongs to him. We wish him well. We wish his family well. We wish the officers, deputies, volunteers, and agents who brought him home the peace of knowing that this time their work ended in the best possible outcome. Before we go, I want to leave you with something. Because if you are a parent listening to this tonight, or an older sibling, or a teacher, or a coach, or anyone who has a young person in your life who you love, you already know that teenagers carry things they don't always say out loud. You already know that a 15-year-old can look fine on the outside and be fighting something difficult on the inside. You already know that the door between my kid is okay and my kid is gone can be thinner than any of us would like to admit. This episode is not a how-to. It is not a lesson. It is not a set of steps. It is a reminder to keep asking, to keep listening, to keep noticing, to keep showing up, even when the conversations are hard, even when the answers are short, even when the walls are high. Because most of these stories do not make the news. Most of them are quieter, smaller, handled inside a single household over a long night with a parent sitting on the edge of a bed and a teenager slowly opening up about something they were afraid to say out loud. That work matters. That work is, in its own way, a search and rescue operation of the heart. And the people who do it every day without ever making headlines are some of the quietest heroes of stories like this. Because sometimes, the story doesn't end in darkness. Sometimes, it ends in a second chance. A boy who was missing is home. A family that was holding its breath is breathing again. A community that had feared the worst is allowed this time to exhale into something better. Not every story on this show ends this way, but this one does. And tonight, we are grateful for that. I'm Maya Vale. This has been Among Monsters. Take care of each other out there. And if you love someone who feels far away tonight, maybe give them a call. You never know which conversation might be the one that keeps the door from closing in the first place.